Hello, everybody. Happy Tuesday and welcome to the newest edition of the Live Stream Live, sponsored by Nobody Still. Soon, I'm having some conversations with some lovely brands that I believe in, and their logo will be right here soon. We will have a sponsor. I'll put it here, and I'll say some nice things about the brand, and it'll be wonderful. But who knows? Maybe even next week. I don't know. So, hey, how's everybody doing? As usual, we are live on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook Live. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can pop them into any of the comment sections in any of those places, and I will do my best to answer them or not answer them or not comment on them if they are weird. As usual, we're going to start it off with me speaking to you about what's been happening, and then we will bring on our guest, Zaid Erzdorn, who is a very cool guy, who I'm very happy to have on the show. And I think you're going to really love to learn and hear what he has to say. But so as we all know, if you live in America, we just had Thanksgiving. And I hope it was okay for everyone. I hope no one had a horrible time, any poopy conversations. I hope no one is still obsessing over the COVID vaccine. Nobody in my house was. No one. Today's show mug is from the wonderful show Ted Lasso. Gotta believe. I love a good mug. I love this show. The show has been nothing but spectacular, and I hear we're getting a new season, which is great. And if you haven't seen it, I suggest you sprint and go see it. Despite it being a holiday weekend, I was very busy with auditions, which is great. I like a bunch of end of the year auditions. It makes me feel nice. It was a bunch of commercials and one for a really cool TV show on a very large network. If anything happens, I will be sure to let you know. I am on like a I don't know what to call it. It's like a loose hold or like a loose availability check for something cool. It's a commercial. I will, of course, let you know if it turns into anything. You probably hear me say that a lot. Hey, I'm on hold. Hey, there's a thing that I'm going to be a part of. Hey, maybe yes, maybe no. But that's just what kind of happens in the magical world of entertainment. There's a lot of, hey, we like you. Hey, why don't you hold these dates? Hey, why don't we, never mind. And then you just kind of move on to the next thing. In the beginning, it was kind of frustrating. Now it's just kind of par for the course. So you just get used to it. You know, things come along at a constant clip. So it's totally okay. What have I watched lately? So I've been watching Arcane. I've been really watching that show. I didn't really watch it when it first came out because I was working on my own hybrid animation script, and I didn't want it to influence me at all when I was writing it. But now that I'm not writing that anymore, and now that I'm trying to pitch it, I decided to check out Arcane, and it is really good. Have you guys watched the show? It is really, really well done. Just the story and the characters and the voice acting and just everything about it is pretty spectacular, I will say. And I've also played a lot of League of Legends. I've played a lot of Team Fight Tactics, so it is a world that I'm very familiar with. So it already like is baked in for me to, I guess, kind of enjoy it, which is good. I also watched a show, not a show. I watched the movie The Substance. Well, if you don't know what that is, it's body horror is where it would fit. It's I guess it's being like It's like, it's a thriller, but it's not a thriller. It's a horror film, but horror films can't win awards, so they make things thrillers, which is fine. But it's totally body horror. It's the one with Demi Moore, and she's an aging starlet, and there's this injectable that you can take that literally, you basically like bud a younger, more interesting, more amazing version of yourself out of your own spinal column, and you have to spend a week on and a week off, or else you start to like rob each other of life. So as you can imagine, it gets hairy, and the young version wants to just go be young and fun and be out in the world. And she's constantly like taking time from Demi Moore's character. It's very well done. It's very, very stylized. And it's not subtle at all in the messaging that it's trying to send. And I don't think it should be. It's essentially just like, be okay with yourself no matter what is happening around you. And you are beautiful and worthy and fantastic. And it's well performed and well done. It's a heightened version of what Hollywood asks for. But it's not out of the norm, people treating other people in this fashion. Would you ask? What is the reaction in the industry for a producer also being the lead actor? That happens. It's not like a... It's rarer. It's less rare now, because in order to get things that you want to get made, you largely have to be your own producer. Most of the things that I've made that I am like a lead role in, I have made myself, just because I'm a larger guy and there's not a lot of really interesting work for larger guys in the entertainment industry. We usually like punch you in the face or rape you or rob you or blow up a building. But we're more than that. I'm married and I have a daughter and I have another daughter on the way, and I deeply love and have a giant heart. I'm very strong and I'm really tough, but I do a lot of crying. So we are multifaceted folks. But so it's usually, that was a long way around to answer your question, but it's usually people that have a very specific vision, or they wrote it and they're creating something and they're producing something. For example, like a big one is like Ryan Reynolds, right? When he wanted to make Deadpool, he kind of put that up on his own back and made it himself. Wrote everything, went to war for it. That was kind of how that happened. So it's rare-ish. It's becoming less rare. But yeah, so I hope that answered your question. So more seen as someone's art project than in order to be present, they have to be in it. I don't know if it's necessarily someone's art project. I will say that it would be a thing that maybe you want to have a little bit more control over. Maybe it is your specific vision. It could be a passion project, but it's likely just a thing that you don't want to see get messed up, because it can get messed up. It can go through like an algorithm thing, and it can be like, this part of your thing is bad and it won't be good for blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so it's mostly just to protect your vision, because it's probably great. And putting your script into a stupid algorithm isn't really gonna, you know, be all that awesome. So okay, I've rambled enough about that. Let us meet our guest. He is a really cool guy who I'm very happy is here. He is the head of playwriting and script writing at Northeastern in Chicago. He has an incredible podcast about his life, which we will get into. He has written some really cool plays. He's written some cool screenplays. And we actually met in a really cool way. Without further ado, here is our guest. Oh, hey.
Hey, Josh. How you doing?
How are you, man?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Thanks so much for being here. It's really awesome. I'm going to take some wonderful seconds. I've been speaking a lot. So let's jump right in, and I kind of want to talk a little bit about, and I'm sure everyone wants to, but I'd love to talk a little bit about how you came up. From what I understand, you were born as you say underground, on the run from the FBI. Well, you weren't, but your mom and dad were, because they were civil rights activists. Yeah,
they were. I was born in the late 70s, underground, in the sense that my mom was actually on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. She was a founder of an organization called the Weather Underground. They were basically a bunch of white anti-war, anti-racist activists who were kind of allies of the Black Panthers, and basically spent some time in the early 70s blowing up government buildings, the Pentagon, U.S. Capitol, New York Police Headquarters, basically to protest the war in Vietnam and to protest attacks on Black civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King, Fred Hampton, Edgar Evers. So yeah, they were, the FBI would have called them terrorists. They called themselves revolutionaries. They were trying to overthrow the U.S. government. And I was born during that time when they were still on the run underground. And spent my childhood in a very crazy way.
I think I personally think that is incredibly cool. like I know that I'm sure like coming up in it and being related to your parents must have been a very interesting time and a very wild ride, both developmentally and emotionally and all that stuff. But like as a, I don't know, I don't think I'm like a former punk rocker. I mean, I am wearing a sweater now, but you know, I came up in the whole punk alt scene. I protest when it needs to happen. I march for people, and I'm out in the streets when I need to be. You have a very specific, like you've lived this in a way that most people cosplay, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that certainly my parents did, and they were, like you said, we all know people. We all maybe are people who sometimes protest or who like to think of ourselves as politically engaged. My parents were the most, you know, committed radical people I've ever met, and probably most people have ever met. They really lived that idea of kind of if something's wrong in the world, we have to fight with everything we can to change it. And for them, that meant racism. It meant the Vietnam War. And they were willing to risk everything. I mean, they both, you know, they were in college when they became activists. They dropped out. They went on the run. They sacrificed their futures. They ended up in prison. My mom spent a couple of years during my childhood in and out of jail. Many of their friends went to prison for decades or were killed by police or by them, you know, by each other, by in accidents, building bombs and things like that. So it was a dangerous time, and it was a crazy way to grow up. But yeah, like you said, also had cool elements and taught me a lot, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, it's just, yeah. I mean, has it informed your art?
I think it has. I mean, I'm guessing it's probably the reason I'm an artist. You don't know. I'm sure you feel this way as an actor. Like, it's hard entirely to pinpoint, like, I do this because of this reason. But when I think about it, I definitely think for me, you know, telling stories, writing down ideas, writing down things that happened to me has always been a way of kind of trying to understand or make sense of the crazy way I grew up. And sure. I didn't think about it, you know, at the beginning when I was an artist in my 20s, I was just making what seemed cool.
Yeah.
But then I look back at the stuff I made and the way critics wrote about it and what people found in it. And, you know, you can definitely see some themes that start to bubble up that have to do with, you know, growing up in a family that has these kind of very uniquely intense ideas about how to live in the world.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, just from what I've been able to interact with and read and some of your other work, I mean, I put on the promos that you are a revolutionary also. And I think that you are, the way that you write for people, the way that, and I understand that that's what you're supposed to do as a writer. You're like supposed to get into people's heads, but not everybody is very good at that. Yeah. And you seem to have a way in empathetically, where you really get to the feel of either a specific type of person, group of people. And I feel that has to come from, at least a little bit, from being raised in a hyper empathetic environment.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that about my work. But I think you're right. It was a hyper empathetic environment. It was also an environment that involved a lot of what you might call role playing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we, like, literally when I was growing up, we had fake names. We were living fake lives. We had, you know, my parents had fake jobs. When I went to school, I used a different name. I didn't have a birth certificate or a social security number until I was, you know, 7. So I definitely grew up kind of, you know, watching my parents pretend to be other people. And sure. So that can't, you know, that can't be a, I don't want to get too Freudian or anything, but it can't be a coincidence that I ended up being a playwright and wanting to kind of explore what that's like to put yourself in the shoes of somebody else.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, so you started out writing plays. What drew you to that part of the entertainment spectrum? You know, like, I mean, like, sure, it's like where you start is in the theater, but you're still there, right? So you hop in and out of pretty much every possible medium from what I can tell.
Yeah. Well, like you, I mean, you know, I know you as an actor do a lot of, you know, it's like when you're an artist, you have to, both for your own creative reasons and for the kind of jobs that are there, you end up dipping in and out of different worlds, different mediums, right? So for me, I mean, I grew up, I was a movie buff. I loved films. I when I graduated from college, I moved to LA, wrote a screenplay, sold a screenplay, felt like, oh, this is how it works. This is how you do it. And then I had that kind of experience that I think a lot of young writers have in Hollywood, which is like, it's nice to make some money as a 22-year-old, and it's nice to feel like you're part of this glamorous business. But then the work kind of sucks. The people who you're working with are not really interested in making something good. And it can get pretty disillusioning pretty quickly. Yeah. So for me, the theater presented itself as a kind of, I just had this idea when I was in my 20s, like, I didn't like this. The movie didn't get made. I never liked the idea that I was hired to write. You know, it wasn't my idea. It was something somebody read, one of my samples hired me to write their idea. And that happens a lot in Hollywood. And I felt, you know, flattered that they liked my writing. I felt good to be out there working. But ultimately, I felt like I don't want to spend my life writing bad things that never get made. So the theater just popped into my head. I'd never been a big theater kid or anything, but it popped into my head as like, I should go back to my hometown of New York. I should write the kind of things that I think are cool. And if it's a play, you know, it can be everything I want a movie to be. It can be complicated about character. It can be dark and interesting and funny. But I just thought I had a better chance of getting it made, and getting it made the way I wanted to make it, you know, making something good. So that's what led me to playwriting. And then weirdly, many years later, playwriting led me back into other media making, you know, writing for TV, writing for podcasts, writing for interactive media. Just, there's a big pipeline now of the industry looking towards playwrights as, you know, people who can write all sorts of different things. And so that I had a nice like full circle thing of kind of coming back around and getting work that was the kind of work I wished I had gotten in my 20s.
In your 20s. Yeah. It's really interesting how that's changed also. Like for a while, no one wanted any playwrights at all. Yeah. Like they're like, why, you don't know anything about story. Like what do you mean? You know, but it's total bullshit. Like it's, you know, like I had kind of like a, like I thought I was only going to do theater. Very specifically, I thought I was only going to do Shakespeare forever. Yeah. That's exactly like, I was like, I'm doing this. That's it. I'm good at it. I have good voice. I got the presence. So I trained and all that stuff. And I could like do all the sword fighting and all that shit. But it was actually one of my ex-girlfriends said to me, like, you're obsessed with movies. Yeah. Obsessed with them. And I was like, no, they're fun. I like to watch them. Like, but I'm a stage actor. I'm gonna do Shakespeare. I'm obsessed with. And she was like, how many movies do you watch a year versus how many plays do you watch a year?
Yeah.
And it kind of like struck me in the brain where I was like, I see probably like a 10-to-1 ratio mm-hmm. of movies to plays. Or like, you know, and is it just the accessibility or is it, do I prefer to see stories in that medium? And I still don't really know the answer. I love them both so much. I haven't done a lot of theater in the past 10 years. I've done mostly TV and film. Part of that is having a family. It pays a lot more as you mentioned earlier. And like you can make money there, but I do find that I've been fighting to tell my own stories there harder than I had to when I was in the theater.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's also true that in addition to the money, like movies, television, that's where the cultural conversation of our time is happening, right? Yeah. So theater is amazing. You can see great things, but you know, 90% of theater done in America is old, dead playwrights, Shakespeare, Ibsen, you know, which is great. I mean, I love that stuff too. But if you're trying to like say something specific as a writer about our current moment, that's a very tiny sliver of what the theater audience in America is about, you know? So yeah, you get drawn the other direction. And I'll tell you something else, you know, I'm a Shakespeare guy too. I got into the theater loving to watch Shakespeare, to be in Shakespeare. You know, one thing, I'm gonna get the numbers wrong probably, but the statistic is something like during Shakespeare's time, the average person in London saw like between 1 and 2 plays a week, right? So that's cool. It was like the way we think of now film, television, just like part of the cultural moment, right? Everybody was in the conversation. And that's why you could have somebody like Shakespeare, because he could count on an audience that not only came regularly and could support an industry, but also was part of that kind of conversation. If he made a reference to a play that came out 2 years earlier, they would know it and they would, you know, be part of that kind of interactive moment with them. And you know, I don't know if we're there anymore in theater in America, but in film and TV, we certainly are. We can kind of build on each other's cultural references and have that conversation.
I mean, it depends on the theater and where it's being done. Like,
sure.
Certainly not in the commercial theater space. I mean, it's to some degree, but it certainly has been, you know, because it's got to go like through the paper mill and then come back yeah. around and
yeah.
you know, and then yeah. come and then get like rewritten and rescored and blah blah. And it's usually a musical,
yeah.
you know, like other than like Sarah Rule. I yeah. haven't seen a new contemporary play. Like she just did one at Lincoln Center 6 months ago or so, or six or eight months ago. And it was amazing. But people aren't taking monetary chances on new contemporary playwrights.
Yeah. It's rare. It's rare. Really, yeah, I mean, the closest it comes is in, you know, Off-Broadway in New York, which is where I came up, and then Chicago, which is where I am now, where there is a kind of an ecosystem of emerging playwrights. There's an ecosystem of theaters willing to do risky work. There's actors who are talented enough to present that work, designers, you know, but yeah, especially post-pandemic, those places are really struggling to find an audience, you know.
Somebody in the chat mentioned your name, which is it's a great name. mentioned that it's both biblical, and are you named after anyone specific?
Yeah, that's another crazy story. So I come obviously from a strange background. My mom was raised Jewish. My dad was a WASP. But Zaid, I was actually named after a friend of theirs, a guy named Zaid Malik Shakur, who was a member of the Black Panther Party. And he was actually the Minister of Information for the New York Black Panthers. And he was killed by New Jersey police in a shootout, same shootout in which Assata Shakur was arrested. So he was a Black nationalist, a revolutionary freedom fighter. He died a couple years before I was born, and my parents named me after him as a kind of a commemorative thing. But he had taken the name Zaid Shakur, which is an Arabic name, Muslim name, when he converted to Islam.
Yes, it was. So before I had seen you or heard you or whatever, I had very randomly, I met Zaid because I was cast in a partial reading of one of his amazing scripts. And when I first saw your name, I was like, oh, he's a Black guy. I was like, cool. And I heard you were not going to be there because it was a WGGA event where scripts that are either not pitched yet or whatever were read aloud. You were teaching in Greece at the time. So there was this like Zoom interview at the end, and everyone else in the union, you know, knows who you are, but we're not part of the Writers Guild. So we just kind of show up and we're like, oh, let's meet some people and blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then you popped on the screen and I was like, what in the fuck? In the beginning of the interview, they were like, well, you know, because of your life, but everybody knows about your life, Zaid. And I was in the front row, like, who the fuck? No one knows. like, I don't know. I just like started to try and talk to you, and it worked out.
It worked out. It worked out great. I mean, I love the Writers Guild. I've been a member since the beginning of my career, 10, 15 years ago. And they do this contest every year called, I forget what it's called, Pilots Interrupted or something. And it's basically for a new pilot that, you know, you submit, they judge it, they pick a drama and a comedy to do these kind of stage readings at Lincoln Center. And it's a great program because, you know, so much good work that's being done by members of the Writers Guild isn't getting made because only one tiny, tiny fraction of the pilots written actually get produced, even at that level of the Writers Guild members.
So small.
And of course, there's some work, maybe like the pilot that you read, that are either too strange, too political, too something to kind of like be a mainstream show. I mean, I still have hopes for that show. I think it'd be a cool show on TV, but you know, but it's got its difficulties too. And so I really appreciate the Writers Guild being like out there kind of advocating for their writers and for their most, you know, their riskiest and strangest work.
It's an incredible script, and I would love to see it happen, obviously. But I would, it's just on its own, it's great. I mean, I don't know if you can say anything about it. Probably not, but
I can say a little about it if you want. Right. I mean, it's you did a great job reading it, Josh, and Josh played the lead in this reading. But it's a period piece set in New York, the turn of the century, and it's kind of an interesting moment in New York history where sexualities of all kinds were being sort of experimented with and contested. It's sort of like today. You had different, you know, people coming out as gay or trans or whatever, you know, these are words they didn't use back then, but that was basically the idea, kind of troubling the gender binary and thinking in new ways about gender and sexuality. And meanwhile, just like we have today, you had this massive counter reaction where some of the political elite of New York were really trying to kind of crush any sense of like experimentation and strangeness in downtown New York, Manhattan. So Yeah, I think the pilot, I won't say much more about the pilot because it's still out there and about to, you know, we're about to go out and pitch it. But I think of it as kind of a weird combination of like Moulin Rouge and Goodfellas. It's like a very dark sort of club sex violence type of show.
Yeah, when I was speaking to my wife about it, I was like, it's kind of like a queer American Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, that's exactly you know? Right. That's exactly yeah, right. Like, it's like Peaky Blinders and with a little bit of showmanship and set in a kind of a queer nightclub.
I think it'll find a place to live. It's super interesting and really cool and just very well done. Just anyway, like I spoke to you about why I fucking love it.
Yeah.
But, thanks, man. Yeah. What brought you into education? You know, like you run a entire creative program where you are quite literally shaping the art form's future. So how did you do that? How did you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess I came at it first as a student long before I was a professor. I became a playwright in college because of the playwriting teachers I met there. You know, I, like a lot of kids who want to be creative, but I wasn't sure. I don't think I knew a single person who was a professional playwright when I was growing up. I didn't even know that was a thing. But then I went off to college. I took some writing workshops and some of my professors, I was at Brown. And my playwriting professor, the year I was in her class, she won the Pulitzer Prize in drama. And I thought, wow, you can be this brilliant artist and be a teacher and be actually making a living doing what you're doing. So that's kind of what planted the seed. And then, you know, like a lot of people in the theater, I went to a bunch of schools. I mean, I started at Brown. I ended up getting my MFA at NYU. I was at Columbia for a while. I was at Juilliard for a while. I did a 2-year fellowship as a playwright at Juilliard. So I was kind of in this world of, you know, writing education. And I met all these great mentors who taught me how to do what I do. And so I was just always interested in that exchange of like young writers, mid-career writers, how like mid-career writers can shape, as you said, the next voices in American writing. And also how those I now know that those mid-career writers actually can get a lot out of knowing those young and up-and-coming writers. It kind of is an interesting feedback loop that happens. So yeah, I was a freelance. Yeah, I was a freelance writer in New York for like 6 or 7 years. It was great, but it's also, you know, it's a grind and it's like, you know, you're always kind of looking for that next gig, looking for what's going to come next. And Northwestern offered me this job being a professor of writing. And I thought, you know, I admired my professors of writing so much when I was coming up, I'll try it out. Came to Chicago, started teaching there. And then, yeah, now I'm running the MFA program.
That's really cool. I mean, and how's it going? Like how is the new generation doing?
They're doing so great. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, first of all, my colleagues are brilliant. There's about, you know, six or seven of us playwriting professors in my program. And they're such talented and amazing writers. And then it's a very small program on the graduate level. We only let in 4 writers every year. And they're fully funded. It's free. They get a stipend, they get health insurance. And so it's a way to kind of like pick the best young writers in America and say, like, we're going to give you 2 years to learn from these established writers and to practice your craft without having to worry about a day job or whatever else it might
be. That's amazing. That never happens anymore. Like that.
It never happens anymore. It's a pretty unique program. And because it's a unique program, you know, we, along with the, you know, there's a couple other programs, Yale and Brown and Juilliard, that are kind of set up like that. But it means that we, along with those places, really can pick the people we think are the most important young writers coming up in the country or the world. So yeah, we have right now 8 writers, 4 in the first year, 4 in the second year. And they're, you know, staggeringly talented. They're brilliant. And we have, since I've been here, I've been at Northwestern 10 years, and our list of alums, you know, they're incredible. Will Arbery is, you know, winning insane awards on and off Broadway and writing for Succession. And, you know, we have writers on The Bear. We have writers, you know, almost every show you could think of are alums of our program. So
that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's great. Has anyone run into, so I don't know how to ask this question, but like, self censoring, I guess, like, feeling like they're not allowed to write about specific things for whatever reason. Have you, run into any of that stuff?
Oh yeah, no, it happens all the time. And in fact, I think it's one of the big things we pitch about our program is that we are, you know, fiercely devoted to championing the work of young writers, whatever they want to write. And we don't do the thing where it's like, you're not allowed to write that story, or you have to be careful and you can't take risks and you have to kind of, you know, you got to avoid offending people. You know, we try to remind our students that, you know, sometimes as a writer or as an artist, you take big swings, and sometimes you miss, and sometimes you're going to get an ugly review in the New York Times, you know, and we've all been there. But if you don't take the swings, and if you don't take the risks, you're not going to make anything great. So
that's awesome.
I think, you know, absolutely the self-censorship happens, and the censorship happens. I mean, people do get sort of like told that they should not be writing that thing, and we try to push back on that. Yeah.
Well, because I mean, it's been happening a lot in like acting programs where people have been very like, I'm not saying like people are like, you should do blackface. That's not what I'm saying. But there has been a lot of like, you can't experiment in this way as an artist because you're not allowed to, and it cuts off so much of a person's artistic growth to say like, no, like maybe you won't use it. Like, especially when you're in class or when you're in school, that's where you fuck up. Like, you mess up there and learn. And people being told that they're not allowed to do that anymore in a lot of places is producing a very strange artist. I've worked with a few of them, like newer folks, and they're very good. They just have their perspective on the like art as a whole is very different from when maybe you and I were going through school. Yeah. And I do understand that times change and things change. I'm not a dumb.
And look, there's a part of it that's good, right? People, you know, it's right for artists to be challenged and to be aware of the history of their art form and the kind of inequalities that have existed and all that stuff. I mean, it's right that artists should be challenged to do better. And by better, I just mean make better art. Like with most things, if you do it brilliantly, you're not going to have a problem. It's when you do it badly, when you try to, you know, impersonate a person or you know, write a voice that you don't understand or that you can't access. Of course, you should be criticized for that. And people are. The problem is, like you said, when artists get timid, you know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with criticism. I think artists should get criticized. But I think we, as especially as fellow artists and as mentors, we have to stand up for the young artists and say, like, yeah, I mean, okay, they fucked up there, but like, they should still take another swing. You know, they have to. If you get timid, the whole game is over. So you have to somehow figure out how to be complicated about this stuff, but be brave at the same time.
That's great, and that's awesome, man. I'm happy that's happening with you in your program. It's great.
And we've got some bold writers. I mean, they are, you know, even in the kind of climate that you're talking about, some people writing some very edgy and provocative stuff. So I'm proud of them. Yeah,
that's great. That's fucking great. So you being in Chicago, you seem to interface with some of the local theaters, specifically with the Good Men. I want to talk a little bit about Revolutions. It is, so I didn't get to see it. I didn't even know that it was a thing until you emailed me. So you worked with Tom Morello, who, for those of you that don't know who that is, he was in a band called Rage Against the Machine, who's one of my favorite bands. And he is, you know, he lives in that revolutionary space that you live in and your parents lived in. And you created a really cool hybrid show. Can you speak a little bit about it?
Yeah. So it's crazy. It's my first musical. I've written, you know, 8 or 9 plays, never written a musical because I'm not a super musical person. And because the musical form doesn't necessarily fit my aesthetic as a playwright, but a bunch of years ago, I guess like 2020, 2019, kind of pandemic era, I was looking for people to collaborate with. I had this idea for a show. And yeah, so I texted Tom Morello, who's this, you know, he's an incredible, maybe one of the greatest rock guitarists ever. And he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's won a million Grammys. He's a legendary kind of performer and musician. And one thing people don't know about Tom, I think, is like a lot of people know his stuff from Rage Against the Machine or from Audioslave. And, you know, he's got this kind of punk edge to him, but he's also got kind of a solo project called The Night Watchman, which is more like Dylan-esque folk sort of music.
Oh, really?
And then he's got another project called The Street Sweeper Social Club with Boots Riley, the rapper and filmmaker, where it's kind of like a hip hop duo where Tom plays guitar and Boots raps. So anyway, if you listen to Tom's whole catalog, the punk rock anthem stuff is amazing. But it really, his catalog spans every vibe, every emotion, every genre you could think of. Hmm. So as I started to listen to it, I was like, I think there's like a story that could happen here. It's not just the hard rock stuff. It's like there's ballads, there's love songs, there's political songs. So yeah, I called him up. I pitched in this project. He was super into it. I hadn't even written it yet. So he was just like, yeah, man, you know, if you want to use my music and write a show, like, I'm not guaranteeing that I'll do it, but if it's good, we can talk about it. Yeah. So I went off, I wrote a script and he liked it. And then, so we're working on, you know, did it the Goodman, working on the next iteration of it, maybe bringing it to New York. And it's kind of this big, hip hop, punk rock musical about two generations of kind of radicals and criminals in Chicago. And it's a pretty cool show. And Tom's music is just so cool, and you've never heard anything like it in a American theater, so it's gonna be a fun show to do.
I mean just from what I read in the piece that was on the website, which is linked in the bio of everything, so you go look at it. It is so interesting. It is it's just like you said, it's rap and it's punk and verse and it's everything that you like and is really interesting kind of coalesced into a cultural soup, which is really cool.
Exactly that.
Yeah,
super cool. And Tom also is from Chicago, which, you know, he was in LA, but he came out to Chicago while we were working on it, the Goodman. He was here for couple months, kind of, you know, hearing the show and giving notes and tweaking the music and talking us through it and stuff. And so, yeah, it's been a great collaboration. He's an awesome artist and an awesome guy.
That's cool. Your podcast, Mother Country Rebels, it's like a walk through your own history with your family. And when I was listening to it, first of all, like, sounds exactly like every awesome podcast I've ever listened to. Really well done. Why a podcast and not like a TV show? Like, your parents' story could make a compelling show, movie.
So that's a funny one. It's another one of the examples of like starting out in a weird place and kind of coming back around. I actually did write it first as a TV show. I got hired by Showtime, or I pitched it to Showtime and got hired to write a pilot right before the pandemic. Uh-huh. And I wrote a pilot that I really liked. It's kind of about my parents' story. And people seemed pretty enthusiastic about it. And then the pandemic hit and the show, you know, everything shut down and the show wasn't getting made. And what actually happened is that one of my executives from Showtime called me up, and she was actually at Fox 21, which is the studio that was doing the show for Showtime. And she had moved during the pandemic from Fox 21 to Crooked Media, which is the podcast company that does Pod Save America and a bunch of other things. And she basically said to me, look, everything's shut down because of the pandemic. That pilot is so cool. Would you want to do it as an audio show? And I was like, I don't know how to make an audio. I don't know how to make a podcast. I don't know how to do that. And she was like, you know, I'll hook you up with people who know the audio side. You're the writer. You write the script and we'll make it happen. So yeah, she convinced me that it was a cool thing. I spent a year during the pandemic writing this show. It's a 10-part series, kind of telling the history of the Revolutionary Undergrounds of the 1960s and 70s. So it's basically my family, the Weather Underground, and also a group called the Black Liberation Army, which was the most like militant offshoot of the Black Panther Party. And it was just super fun to work on. I had some great collaborators, a woman named Misha Youssef and a woman named Ariana Lee, who really knew the podcast world and could kind of do the audio editing and stuff that I didn't know how to do. So I wrote it, I narrated it. We had a bunch of other voices and interviews and archival footage and stuff to cut together. And yeah, it turned out really well. I think it's a great show, and it turned into like a big thing. You know, we had 2 million listeners and just kind of like one of those things where it hit at the right time when people were really interested in that question of like racial violence and kind of resisting racism and how people have done that over the decades and centuries. So yeah, check it out. It's called Mother Country Radicals. It's on every platform and on Crooked Media's website.
It is also very much linked in and all the videos too. What I liked about it the most is that you didn't shy away from anything that was ugly or hard or upsetting, especially as a son, to learn some pretty crazy things about your own parents, and then having the courage, I guess, to just show the world what it was, and then not like ultra commenting on how it made you feel, but being like, this is what it was, and this is why it had to be this way, was very compelling and very admirable to do, because a lot of people would maybe try and hide some of what you laid bare. So I think that's part of, I mean, it's a crazy story. It's really cool and it's really interesting, but you also came at it with such honesty, which is hard to find nowadays.
Thanks, Josh. I think you learn pretty quickly as a writer, as a playwright, as a screenwriter, that like if you're not that people can see through, if you're trying to hide something, or you're trying to or you don't go to the dark places, you don't go to the kind of honest places that like freak you out, then nobody's going to be that compelled by the story, right? So I'd never really written anything about my family before, and I was a little bit nothing directly about them before this. And I was nervous, like anybody would be, to write about their own parents and put it out there in the world. But I also I felt from the very beginning, especially because my parents are controversial people. You know, there's plenty of people who have written stuff about them treating them as heroes. And then there's plenty of other people who have written stuff about them treating them as villains and terrorists and evil anti-American terrorists, right? So I felt like what I could add to it was some kind of like real close up intimate honesty about like what I see and what I thought about them, and that was the only way to kind of convince my audience that they were going to hear something real and not just, you know, hear a son bragging about his parents, which wasn't what I wanted to do,
you know? It's great. So yeah. and you're a dad, and how has, I mean, there's a very obvious answers, like you're not on the run from the FBI and you're not underground, but as a parent, how has that changed how you are as a dad?
First of all, I have two teenage daughters. They're brilliant. They're both kind of artists. One's a visual artist, one's a writer and a journalist. So I feel like I have a lot in common with them, in the sense of like they're more like me than I am like my own parents. You know, I was always the observer and the kind of the person who was like checking things out and writing things down, whereas my parents were the ones out there like actually fighting the man and blowing up bombs. So that dynamic was always complicated. But, you know, like any kid who's grown up, I mean, my parents were great parents, but, you know, when you're growing up in those sort of circumstances that can be traumatic, where your mother's going to prison and you're, you know, never not sure if she's ever going to get out and your friends are being killed. And, you know, when you become a parent yourself, you try to be, I guess, extra careful about giving them a life that feels stable and that feels like, you know, a little bit more predictable. That being said, our family's pretty weird too. So my kids are growing up in their own weird thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I had my own weird thing too when I was a kid. Yeah. Like, I came up homeless and I was in foster care, and, you know, I like had a biological mom who was a crackhead prostitute, like just like stuff like that. So I feel like and the way that I'm it's the same deal. Like, you know, I have a house, I try to make things really, really stable, yeah, kind, talk about stuff, you know, keep things even keel. But, you know, I'm also married to a really cool artist, and my daughter seems like she's gonna be a cool artist too. And that part of it is super awesome, and I want to cultivate that and be as weird as you fucking can. Like,
for sure.
Everything is way too horribly serious all the time, and the world's always exploding and shit's on fire. Be weird and, you know, take pictures and be cool. Like, yeah. So it's nice to hear that from some other person that has also had kind of like a wild upbringing.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, we are just about at an hour, so I'm going to say, if anybody's got any questions or they have anything that they want to say, please pop them in the chat now. We will, you know, speak for a couple of more minutes, and then we'll probably wrap it up. But all of Zaid's links about everything that we have spoken about are literally in at the bottom of this video that you are watching. It's to the play, to his podcast, to his personal website, where you also have your other plays up, which is very, very cool. Are you on social media at all?
Yeah, I was on Twitter, but I'm really not anymore. But I'm kind of on Instagram at Zaid Dorn, and I'm kind of on Blue Sky at Zaid Dorn. You know, I'm not as good about it as I should be, but you can certainly check me out there, and I can be reached there.
Cool. A lot of people saying that you're really impressive, which is cool, which is true, and that you have a great personality. Like, I know that. Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, that's nice. Cool, man. This has been a great conversation.
Super fun, Josh. Thank you. Yeah,
I really appreciate you being here. And I'll let you go, and I'll speak to you soon, okay?
For sure. We'll do it.
Thank you. Okay, everybody, thank you so much for being here this evening. I really appreciate it. If you're watching on YouTube, please like and also subscribe. Please check out all of the links that are below this wonderful video. I also have merch offerings. I have a membership that costs $5 a month, where you get access to behind the scenes things, anything that I've ever created or made. You get to hear me just say things that are off the cuff and fun. I really hope you had as much fun as I did having this amazing conversation. Have a beautiful, beautiful evening, and I will speak to y'all so soon. Thank you for coming to the live stream live. Have a great night.